Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week it's my very great pleasure to introduce Frederick Forsyth. We're celebrating not a new book, but The Day of the Jackal, his first novel, which is 50 years old this month. Freddie, welcome.
Thank you very much. Be kind.
To start with, I mean, The Day of the Jackal is now an absolute kind of monument in the landscape of thrillers of the last century. But obviously, you know, when you were writing it, it wasn't yet. Can you start by giving me a sense of the world in which you were writing it and where you were and how it came about?
Well, it was, I mean, looking back over 50 years, I'm still as bewildered now as I was then. It is unusual. Most things clarify with the passage of time, but this one hasn't, because to this day, it is an oddity that it ever succeeded. I think it was grossly unfair that it succeeded the way it did, not to me, but to all, not to Michael, the other strivers, because normally if a book's going to go that big, that quickly, which it did after launch, it's a result of years of struggle, of practice, of drafts and rejects and a drawer full of rejection slips and several attempts at a novel and, oh gosh, you know, years of study and role models and trying to imitate someone else. It shouldn't have happened this way, but it did. Basically, this total newcomer, back from an African war where he'd been a foreign correspondent, fired by the BBC yet, discredited by the Foreign Office, decided on a whim, I suppose, to try and get out of the financial mess he was in and pay off his debts by writing a novel. Now that, as a recipe, is as daft as it gets, because you know you just don't write a novel to settle your debts. First of all, I didn't realize then, it's a very slow business. The writing of it is slow, the placing of it is slow, the rejections take time, and then normally a lot of time after that, when the book is at sale, but slowly building. None of this happened. I sat down on the 2nd of January, 1970, and I just started to type. I had a portable typewriter, which I'd traveled all over Africa with. It even had a bullet scar in the metal casing on it, where some kind soul had fired through the wall of the hut I was in at the time, and it slashed across the top of this thing. So I took the steel cover off and began to type. And that's all I had. I had 500 sheets of white A4 paper and an idea. And then I literally dashed off 350 pages in 35 days. And you might say, well, that was a good first draft. Look, it's never been changed. I don't know why. Not a line, not a word, not a phrase has ever been changed from that day to this, which is weird when you think about it. I mean, it's seriously weird. And then I hawked it around, and I was so naive, I didn't understand why it was being rejected. I didn't know about rejections. every author, you didn't know about rejections. I mean, really, really successful people like Ken Follett had 10 before Key to Rebecca, which was his big breakthrough. And then I think John le Carré's Spider in the Cold was third. And here was I with my debut, shunting it from publisher to publisher, wondering why it was rejected. So I got three rejections, which is nothing compared to what most young writers have to put up with. I withdrew it from the fourth because the fifth, Harold Harris at Hutchinson, agreed to have a look at it. And he was the editorial director. Now, I realized that up till then, it had only ever been seen by readers, mostly students, on summer leave maybe, earning a few bob and pin money by reading unsolicited draft manuscripts, which are so unwanted in the publishing profession that they are trolleyed down the corridor between the readers' booths or whenever they come in. And the readers are asked to go through this often unreadable manuscript and prepare a 500-word synopsis for the editorial director, who will then decide whether there's anything that he wants waste time or spend time reading. And that was why I was getting rejected, because each of the readers was saying to the editorial director, well, it's a story about someone trying to assassinate Charles de Gaulle. he was still alive, you see, in the spring and summer of 1970. He was still alive. He died in November. So reasonably, the query was, well, what the hell is it all about? Well, how can there be any tension in a story about a man being assassinated who is still alive? And that was why it came back and came back and came back.
Had this occurred to you when you were writing it that you were going to have to do it differently, or that it was working differently from other thrillers?
No, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about the publishing world, about novel writing world, about structure, about chapters and this and the other. I was just a total tyro. And I just wrote it, I suppose, in the manner of a journalist, which is what I was, after all. I'd been for 12 years since coming out of national service. I'd been a reporter and then a foreign correspondent and then latterly a war correspondent. You know, we're both journalists, so we know the rules, which are basically, you don't get many rewrites in journalism. I mean, the editor wants it, or the sub-editor wants it. He wants it now. If you're in a newspaper, there is a deadline, usually some 10 p.m. when the thing goes to bed. You can't just say, well, I'll have that back at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. I'd like to rewrite several paragraphs. So you get it right first time, or it doesn't get printed. So therefore, I was my aim, if you like, was to get it clear and lucid and accurate, first draft. I didn't know I'd done it. That was extraordinary. I just didn't know I'd done it. But apparently I had, inadvertently. So what a fluke.
That business of the journalistic side of it sort of fascinates me, because, you know, one of the things your jackal does, particularly in the first part of the book, is, you know, he goes and he reads every day's Le Figaro. He goes and he researches de Gaulle's personality and character in order to kind of inhabit what de Gaulle would do and how to get to him. Did you have to do the jackal's job to produce a novel? I mean, did you do that work to try and figure out how you'd get de Gaulle?
Yes, I did. I read all that stuff in the reading room of the British Library, the old Figaros of the time, because I had been in Paris as a Reuters correspondent, part of the Reuters team, back in 62, 63. I lived through all that I was writing about. I was there at Petit Clamart, which is where the OAS damn near assassinated him. I mean, they riddled his car with bullets. There were, I think, six attempts in all. They included exploding flower vases next to where his car passed. So they failed, basically, because, well, they weren't very good as assassins. And I watched them and thought...
Were you on the spot when the assassination attempt happened?
Yeah. Back in 62, 63, I was based in Paris, watching them happen, one after the other. I think I watched three, then I was posted to Berlin. But anyway, when I was in Paris, I watched all this happening. I got to know the bodyguard, his bodyguards, including particularly Roger Tessier, who was the Parisian boy. I went back to interview him, actually. And he was very forthcoming about the way they kept de Gaulle alive. But even at the time, I looked at them, I thought, I don't think they're going to get it. Why? Well, because they've been blown. They've been penetrated. There was the French counterintelligence people were very, very smart and utterly ruthless. And they had infiltrated the OAS. And so every time the OAS had a meeting with three or four present, one of them was on the government payroll. And that was why they were getting picked up in droves. As fast as they only had to put their nose out of the door, bang.
There's not a lot of interest in your old due process there, was there?
No, no. In fact, the Action Service, which is the special unit inside the SDECE, French intelligence, or counterintelligence anyway, we actually recruited the Corsican Mafia. I mean, that is like recruiting the Krays to keep the Prime Minister alive. You know, it's pretty dire stuff. The Corsican Mafia, particularly a group called the Orsinis, were given as a reward virtually carte blanche on the whole Côte d'Azur for their criminal activities, particularly prostitution, as a reward. I mean, This is something you wouldn't get away with in Britain, but they were absolutely ruthless. I suppose they were justified. They were trying to keep the head of state alive. He was going to be assassinated. It was unusual in most of Europe. But apart from Olaf Palme, I can't think, or it was one in Israel. It's very rarely the head of government is assassinated anyway. And these OAS people were ex-soldiers, they were ex-Foreign Legion, and a pied noir from northern Algeria. And they were skilled gunmen. I mean, you know, they weren't just any old riffraff off the street. They were the top, they thought. But they met even better in the form of the Action Service. So I thought, if I describe all this, I don't think most people out there know this. So hopefully I'll be interesting them in some way, exposing what really happened and how it was done, the skullduggery involved. And therefore, yes, I did. I studied de Gaulle's, so the Jackal, this imported assassin who was going to use a sniper rifle, would pick his moment and the ceremony where he would try and drill de Gaulle's head with a bullet. And I picked the celebration the presentation of medals on the 25th of August, 1963, I think, on the left bank as the light time when he would be available, visible, out in the open. He refused to take any precautions. De Gaulle and just haughtily stalked through, sneering at his tormentors and his assassins.
In the book, he's very, you know, part of the difficulty of looking after him is he absolutely refuses to concede anything to security.
That's right.
For his dignity. Was that absolutely from life?
Yes, he was. In fact, if you think back, there's a picture of him stalking down the Champs-Élysées in 1944, the liberation of Paris, and a sniper opens up on that crowd, and they all melt, except one man. Head stuck up in the air, great big hooter stuck out front, kepi, uniform, two-star general, stalking down the Champs-Élysées, and his attitude was, screw you. I mean, you know, I'm not going to run. The ruse of surrounding him at the Arc de Triomphe with particularly tall officers, that was true, that happened. They did try and shield him. And he didn't know, they didn't tell him that they were doing this, but there's something, all the officers around are about 6'3". Anyway, there we are.
Yeah. Now, one thing you would have said, you know, political assassination is rare, or the assassination of heads of state is rare. You've got a bit in the book where you say the lean and fanatical colonel in Rome had devised a plan that could still bring the whole edifice tumbling down by organising the death of a single man. Some countries have institutions of sufficient stability to survive the death of a president or the abdication of a king. But Rodify was well aware of the state of the institutions of France in 1963. The death of the president could only be the prologue to putsch and civil war. Was that true then? And was it special about France?
No, it really was. First of all, they had taken a humiliating defeat at Dien Bien Phu when they'd lost all their Indochinese, their three Indochinese provinces, Dien Bien Phu by the Viet Minh. And so Algeria was the last, if you like, of their major overseas colonies. And it was part of metropolitan France. It was a passionate cause, both for the French who lived there and for the army that had lost members in this long, long war against the FLN. So when he came to office and realized, being a pragmatist, he wasn't left of center, but he was definitely a pragmatist, that the days of empire were over. Something that Macmillan recognized, and hence the Wind of Change speech. De Gaulle realized that you couldn't hold on to Algeria forever. They had 500,000 men in Algeria. It was bleeding France white economically. They were taking casualties all the time. And it was a very highly emotive issue, Algeria. He quietly began to negotiate at Evian with Ben Bella, the FLN leader. This leaked out. Well, it was an explosion of rage. And it wasn't just the pied noir of North Africa. It was also the right, everything right of center of France said he must be brought down. Then you had the biggest communist party in Europe was the Parti Communiste Français. That was obviously extreme left. So this was a cauldron of marching left-wing students, of marching right-wing fanatics, meeting each other sometimes in clashes. The CRS, Republican Corps de Securité, as they called it, which was militia, armed police, was formed basically to break them up. And this was a country on the threshold possibly of implosion. So everything was at stake.
Do you think that sort of situation is one that obtains still in the world, I mean, in the first world anywhere, that the assassination of a head of state could cause a collapse in that way? Or was that a special moment in history?
It depends on the country. If it's a stable country with a constitution it can rely on, then even the assassination of an American president, as happens, we know, in 1963 in Dallas, the country can survive, government can survive. There is not universal chaos and anarchy unleashed by the death of one man. In other countries, well, yes, possibly, but I mean, we've just had an assassination.
Haiti, hasn't it?
Yeah. Haiti, a few days ago. And there are other countries where, yes, it would bring the whole government down. But this is normally when the whole government depends on one man. In a developed and experienced democracy, it doesn't depend on one man. He may be important, but the whole government, the whole country does not usually depend on one single man. In this case, I'm afraid it did. If de Gaulle had gone, I think there would have been a complete collapse of law and order.
Out of interest, did you ever get the sense that the OAS had thought in the way you were thinking, that there'd ever been an attempt to recruit an outside assassin or thinking about those lines of fire in the old plastic?
I don't believe they ever did. I watched it and thought, but privately, and I never vouchsafed to anybody what my private thoughts were. The only way they'll ever get him is with an unknown, well, I wouldn't say necessarily foreigner, but certainly a completely unknown assassin who isn't on the police records, somehow is off the screen. They've never seen him before, never heard of him before, they don't know who the hell he is, but he's out there and he's going to get Charles de Gaulle, he's going to assassinate him. And the French police, the counterintelligence forces, have nothing on him at all. And that would have been, I think, frightening for them. But I don't believe that the OAS Army Council actually ever went that far. I never heard that they said they were contemplating bringing in what you might call an outsider.
You had this, as you say, you sat down with your typewriter and 500 pages of foolscap and an idea. Did you sort of have, how much of the finished book did you have, or did you sort of make it up as you go along? Because it's quite tightly structured. You've got these three parts, you've got the anatomy of a plot, the anatomy of a manhunt, and the anatomy of a killing. You've got your clean skin jackal. Did you, I'm interested how it came together, or did it just come together as you wrote?
Well, no, it didn't quite come together. I mean, I had been thinking about it for some time, even out in the jungles of East Nigeria, I thinking about the story one day that I would write. But it was just a mental exercise. One obviously sometimes in the small hours of the morning thinks, I wonder what would happen if, what would have happened if, would it have been possible to, etc. And I just thought about on these lines and I thought, yes, that could have happened. They could have, yes, etc. And I got some contacts. I had contacts in the underworld. I couldn't go to the authorities because I was a complete non-entity. They don't talk to non-entities. So I had to go the other way. I had to go to a forger to find out how to forge or secure a false British passport. I didn't know that. I described it, as you know, as in the fairly intimately. For some reason, the British authorities never discontinued it. They never stopped it. They could have stopped it.
Is this business of not checking death certificates against birth certificates?
The issue to a complete stranger of the birth certificate and death certificate of someone dead now, that needn't have happened. Or if it was being done for genealogical historical purposes, well, you snip the corner off, and that makes it invalid for an application for a passport. It would have been a very simple little device. Snip the top right-hand corner off. It's a perfectly valid document for a historian, Even a solicitor was perhaps trying to trace an inheritance or something. Yes, you can have that. It's the birth certificate of another, not you, somebody else. But they issue them, as, you know, as, without any damage at all. So that could then be used as the birth certificate that has to be included in the passport application, a first time passport application. And if you put all the filled out documents together, plus the fee, plus a forged reference and the birth certificate, and post it to the passport office, en principe, as the French have it, comes back a passport. And but then not anymore, because the biometric passports don't work that way. It did work for 30 years.
Did the authorities know about this and just not bother to close the loophole? Because obviously your forger friend did.
No, they knew about it all right, because I was rebuked for it. And my response was, for heaven's sake, it's stoppable very, very quickly and simply and easily. It's why the bone idle authorities will not put an end to it. They could if they wanted to. As it happened, the underworld used that methodology, the KGB used it, Stonehouse used it with the Markham scam. And it was only the alertness of Mrs. Markham, the widow, who thought it was odd that he, Stonehouse, my MP, was inquiring for my husband's death, and specifically, did he ever have a passport? So that was alerted her, and she went to the authorities, and that was how he was eventually picked up in Australia, all places.
Having read The Day of the Jackal, possibly.
Oh, yeah, he'd read that, right? He followed to the limit, into the detail, the last detail.
You said you were rebuked for including this detail.
Yes, I think.
But by whom?
Well, various people, not to me personally, but I think in the media, there was thing he's doing.
Oh, you didn't get a knock on the door from MI6?
I didn't get knocks on the door, no. we hadn't gone that far down the road to dictatorship. But no, I did get rebuked in the media by people saying, well, what does he think he's doing? This is giving away state secrets. I wasn't giving away state secrets. It was known, or I wouldn't have got the details. And it was a very simple ruse. Just go to the passport office where other people's birth certificates and death certificates are a public document. You can apply for them.
Now, your jackal, you didn't give him a name. Was that part of the conception from the beginning?
No, I pondered over that. And in fact, it was originally, it was called simply the jackal. And I went through it to the last page. And then the last line was when Lebel was standing over the grave of this still unidentified assassin who was being put in a pauper's grave in Paris. And the last line was, the day of the jackal was over. And then I thought, that's not a bad phrase, you know. And I went back to page one, wound it back into the typewriter and typed the words, the day of, in front. That was how it got its name.
Why did you call him the jackal?
Again, I was looking at an animal, I thought. You could have an eagle, a lion, a wolf, something dangerous, the knight of the clan bear, Then I thought, no, I want something different, something that's never been used before. And I thought, he's very elusive. He comes in the night, he kills, and he disappears by dawn. And I've never seen him used as a creature who is basically a killer, a carnivore. So I'll use him, J-A-C-K-A-L. And then I invented the idea that he might, I only have one fluke in the book, I think, which is that he's mistaken for possibly Charles Calthrop, because C-H-A of Charles and C-A-L Calthrop make Jacques, which is French for jackal. And this man is suspected of being a killer. And when they find his flat empty, the suspicion falls on him. In fact, it was a false lead. And then any detective will tell you there are always false leads.
Yeah. No, it's very, because as I was reading through it, I was like, he has got a name after. Oh, no, he hasn't. Well, I have to hope that any listeners to this aren't giving away the spoilers. In his introduction to the new edition, Lee Child, who knows a bit about thrillers, says, you're kind of, the reader is either rooting for Lebel, the detective, or the jackal. Did you find yourself rooting for Le Bel or rooting for the Jacobins?
No, this is an extraordinary thing. I thought, naive as I was very naive, that this cold-blooded, merciless killer, who would clearly kill a harmless French woman who had seen a sniper rifle in his suitcase, and leave, have no mercy about strangling her, which he did, that this man would be the villain. And this good, meticulous, plodding, sort of honest cop would be the hero. I was quite wrong. And particularly, I'm afraid, among the fairer sex, they wanted to go to bed with Jackal.
He does find time to go to bed with people, which is, you know, it feels like a Fleming-ish touch. Was Fleming someone you drew from or learnt from or admired?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't getting near Bond. I mean, obviously, Bond's hugely much more successful than Jackal, but not credible. I mean, he would never be a secret agent. Far too ostentatious to be a secret anything. Yeah. So no, I wasn't thinking of Bond. It was just a question of, well, basically, what Jackal does in the book is what he has to, what is necessary. He's got to get a new identity. He's entered France. He's been tipped or warned that they're looking for a man. The leak inside the Gaulian establishment has tipped him off. So he, when he paused with his car where the road diverts near Ventimiglia, north to Grasse and central France onwards to Italy. He could have pulled out there. He chose to go, turned left, drove up into France. Now, from that point on, he was a hunted man. He knew he was. So he had to get a new identity. And he seduced this French lady in the first hotel he came to and then strangled her, taking her car and switching identity to the Danish schoolteacher whose passport he'd stolen at Heathrow. And that was the reason why. But he showed no mercy, no regret or hesitation in strangling a perfectly innocent woman in order to steal her car.
You obviously remember it very well. Do you periodically reread it?
No, I never have. Odd. There was a time when on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, someone chose, I think it was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, No, it was Mastermind, sorry. Their speciality subject would be the works of Frederick Forsyth. I thought, I've got to see this. The guy flattened me. He absolutely creamed me. He knew details and minor characters I'd forgotten about. He could name the chambermaid in this particular book. I'd long forgotten. So I haven't remembered an awful lot about what I wrote over the years. But the Jackal, yes, most details of the Jackal I have, because obviously it's been around so long.
You know, you said not a word has ever been changed, and since then you've written very many novels, many of them as successful or nearly as successful as Day of the Jackal. And, you know, you've gone through that process that you've described that most writers go through before they become successful of, you know, sort of learning your craft and going through drafts and drafts. Do you look back at it and think, oh, I should have done that bit differently, or I would have changed this?
I tend not to do postmortems once it's out, or once it's been submitted and it isn't going to be changed anymore, then I tend to leave it alone. I tend not to start postmorteming the thing. I should have done that, should have written that, he should have been that, etc. There's no point. What can't be changed, can't be changed. And I tend to have a sort of, a mindset that can draw a line under the past, the regrettable past, if it can't be changed anymore, but has to be now accepted for what it was, mistake and all. And I leave it like that, so I do it the same with the books.
Well, I think we should leave it like that too. Freddie Forsyth, thanks very much indeed for your time.
Well, thank you.
You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. I very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.